Gang, the coronavirus has proven that it's going to be here for a while. The nasal swab tests are hard to get and very expensive. Well, our friends at ProResults are doing rapid COVID-19 antibody testing to let you know if you have had the virus. They take cash or credit, no insurance needed, no doctor appointment required, and you get your results in 15 minutes. Tell them you heard about them on How Did I Get Here and receive 15% off of your tests. Just go to ProResultsAustin.com/HDIGH or follow the link in the text of this podcast for 15% off antibody testing for COVID-19.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
Right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys all had a good weekend, whatever it is you did this weekend. Probably nothing, because we're all under lockdown and things are going insane. I hope you're healthy, I hope you're safe, and I hope you're sane, wherever it is that you are. Gang, I have a great show for you guys today. It's not a musician. My friend James Robinson, back about a week after Memorial Day, after the murder of George Floyd, talked to me about sitting down and talking to members of the black community here in Austin, and basically getting their experience, what their idea of a solution would be, and all of that kind of stuff, right? So these have been pretty heavy conversations, and some of them have been real long, but they've mostly been with the music community and then the arts community. But today, I am talking to AJ Bingham, who has a lobbying firm here in Austin, Texas, called the Bingham Group. They deal in government affairs, public affairs, and procurement. AJ also has a podcast that has been doing real well. It's called the BG Podcast. They're conversations at the intersection of business, community, and public policy. He's a really fascinating dude, and we have a really great conversation. Basically getting it from the inside. A guy who's on the inside and sees how things work on the state level and the city level. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Mr. AJ Bingham. It's your thing. So I assume this is a day off for you from work.
There's never really a day off. I mean, but for my associate, she mentioned it to me yesterday, like, hey, we have tomorrow off because we're getting a lot of out-of-office replies from the City Hall staff. Like, City Hall is closed today,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I hadn't thought about it just because, you know, I think you're like relate to this too. When you're an entrepreneur, it's – I mean, you actually have to fight hard to give yourself actual vacation times.
Yeah.
I still feel guilty about it, like my own like you're neglecting your child. Yeah. You know, in some way. And I'm saying that, you know, I don't have any kids, but that feeling of I should be doing something, especially when, you know, no one else is doing anything.
Right. Right. Yeah. So speaking of that, how have you been doing for the last month or so?
I mean, it's been a lot. It's been a lot, Johnny. You like John or Johnny?
Johnny.
Like,
Johnny's great.
Johnny.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a lot. You know, it's something I've talked about in my show as well. And at least from a lot of it's like this, and it was things I already knew. So, you know, a lot of we're talking about, Johnny and I were discussing, he was asking, kind of alluding to the last several weeks of protests around the Black Lives Matter movement that was sparked because of the murder of George Floyd. And so start with that, right? That was about a month or so ago. It seems like longer, but just flown by. And a lot of it was, you know, it was stressful. I think a lot because it was things about the murder of George Floyd that I knew already happened about it in America, right? It had happened previously. Eric Garner. I mean, there are cases of this. There have been cases of it since that too that happened, right?
Yeah.
Of police brutality, unnecessary brutality leading to deaths and tragic deaths. And I think it was the fact that, you know, I'm not speaking for every Black American, but I feel this is probably a common thread of Black America is at a certain level to function in this country. We're Americans, you have to almost not disassociate. Yeah, I mean, on a certain level, I think disassociate from it, because if you don't, and you let, and I've said this in writing, if you let every death or the sense of how much racism in this country really acknowledge it fully, it would be debilitating, right? It's too much. We all know it's there. It's almost like you treat it like a background noise. Because you're just trying to, I mean, we're all trying to live our lives. We all want to have a job. We want to advance our careers, find love, get married or not, but just live a life wrapped around all this racism, institutional racism.
Right.
And it can be difficult. I mean, it's enough just to get through a hard day of work and not coming home and wanting to relax TV and then knowing, and you know what stuff's going on, but you're trying just to survive, right? You want to just get through the day, get through the week and enjoy life. And I think it's all been to the good. All these things happening on social media and in the streets too. For me anyway, the social media part, the fact you saw so much of it all the time, you're right, things I already knew, but you're seeing it every day really, really just made me a lot more stressed than usual, right? Because I'm acknowledging things I already know, but like I'm seeing it every day and having to talk about it with people every day. And this held true at least with my black friends. I spoke about it with on my show and also and elsewhere in the community. It's just, no surprises about his death or how it happened. Like that's kind of America, honestly. And it's not diminished. It's just the truth, right? And those are the ones we do know about.
Right.
That being said, I think it's just recognize, the degree of rancor around it and the attention. And then if you're on Facebook or, Instagram or anything else, you saw it as a black person every day. And it's encouraging for sure. But yeah, on a psychological level, it was something that it's like just basically seeing something that you're trying just to like a trauma. You're trying to not acknowledge, it's there, but you're just trying to compartmentalize it so you can get through what you need to get through in your normal average day, right? And it's not something that I think basically a lot of things we're seeing or what that we know Black America knew or why America was waking up to the first time it seemed, at least in the last last two decades. And it's like something new, right? Where it's like this thing, right? Like, not to trivialize it, but it's like something new. And so you want to talk about, even though if and when this period of time ends and until the next national conversation of race comes, because I don't think it'll be one thing. I think I'm hopeful, but not optimistic about that. Right.
Go ahead.
I'm Black American, so it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, whether this happened or not, I'm Black. I'll be always Black till the day after I die. And my children, whether they're with a Black woman or anyone else, they're Black, right? And so, like, that's a common thread. It doesn't matter what your money, much money you have, where you live, how you sound, where school you went to, whatever, however you identify yourself politically, they, them, or the other, right? You're Black. You're Black first. And you forget that in this country at your own peril. I think institutionally, right, you have to remember the context of our color in this country, Black color. And I think I've been very aware of that. I've had a very, I think, on the whole, a very privileged life and opportunities. And I'm very, very aware of that, right? And it's something I think about every day, that I definitely operate in a very white world.
It seems like the people that I've talked to that have grown up in more of a privileged situation, it's still the same thing, just different.
It is. That's a good way of putting it, right? Because you're trading on the whole, as a Black American on the whole, in my immediate family, we've been in a very good position for a long time. And it's like, it's saying, the problems you have are more like white collar problems, right? Like, more about promotions and things like that. At least you have a job, right? At least you still live in this nice neighborhood, or you have, suits and so on. And I think what happens is, as you climb the ladder, ladder professionally and socially, if you will, it gets more nuanced, right? And so, it's not overall, it's like almost in the vein of a first world problem, right? You question like, well, why didn't I get invited to this club or this group? And no one called me, the N-word.
Right.
But it's more insidious because you can't put your finger on it. Why am I being excluded from this? Like, when someone calls you, a word, this and that, or makes it very clear what's up, what's up, right? And you might not like it, but at least you know where I stand with this person in front of me. They don't like me because I'm Black. but it's been very clear and very established. This thing, they say, hey, you shouldn't be here. I get it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I leave, but like, I understand what's up, parameters. And I think if you get hired in so many circles, I mean, you just realize like, it's just, you just can't put your finger on it, right? Because you're more often than not, I think in society, most people aren't going to call you the N-word or, you know, or anything else. You know, we see these videos of Karens and so on, you know, Karen being the kind of the generalized term of white privilege. But those are still, I think, far and between from people's daily interactions, right? And so it's just, it can become harder as you get more established in your career to do. And also on the flip side too, more often than not, the higher you go as a Black American, male or female, but definitely for women too, add that to it, you're more alone, right? On the whole, your peer group, I mean, if you have to really be depending on your metro market, but even like in cities where there's more Black population, there's not, on the whole, like how many Black CEOs there are, Fortune 500 companies, right? And it trickles down. How many Black VPs? How many, you know, because you still want to be amongst your peers, but like you don't see a lot of you, people look like you amongst your peers, right?
Right.
And that can be difficult psychologically, because as we know, like the more, the higher, you know, they always say it's lonely at the top, and it's even lonelier. I think it could be lonelier for Black folks. So, yeah, I mean, it's more nuanced, and then, you know, you're treating one set of issues. Yeah, maybe I don't have to deal with police. This is a good one. This is a good example. I could live in a certain neighborhood. I think about this. Say I have children. I live like in Westlake, right? If I lived in Westlake, and yeah, over there, you know, low crime, beautiful neighborhoods, rolling hills, all this stuff.
Good schools.
But my worry, yeah, great school, like both schools, great schools. My worry would be okay. You know, I'm really a Black family here. In theory, that should be actually a better thing in the sense of people would know, hey, that's the one Black family there, and they know who you are.
Right.
But that's not the case. If anything, it's the opposite. It's like there's more scrutiny on you. And then I'm like, what happens if, and again, not having kids at all, but so I think it's saying, what happens if my kid wants to take my car, just get gas on the street? I wouldn't, or even wants to, you know, work out and run in his neighborhood. In the neighborhood, it's his neighborhood, right? Run around, work out outside. I think about that now, I'm like, shit, because all it is, sorry, pardon my friend, sorry.
No, go ahead.
It's like, okay. What happens if someone's like, oh, I saw a Black kid running in the neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
And that concept, I think about that now. I don't have children.
Yeah.
Right? I don't even have like a wife. It's just, but that's the kind of thing that my mind runs, because that's a very real scenario. What happens if there's going on the street, like Trayvon Martin, just get gas, or in this case, get dad's car. This is dad's car. I'm just going to get off my dad. The cop's like, oh, who, you know, who's, this is a really nice car. Whose car is my dad's? And getting gas. Like, either the cop can believe him or not. And 9 times out of 10, if it's a white kid, and they believe him. Black kid, depending on the cop, maybe not. And that's, I've had personally nothing. My interactions with police have always been, they've been legit. Like, you know, if I got a speeding ticket, it's because I was legitimately speeding. Right. Like, there's no like local room. I was speeding, or the times when I need to help, I got it right. I've never had personally a bad interaction with police, but that, you know, I've been lucky.
Right. Yeah.
I've just been lucky. That's it. I've been lucky. I've been in the right place at the right time, and I've been in the right place at the wrong time, or the wrong place for the wrong time.
Is there, when you get pulled over, is there any kind of like?
No, it's like, strict. I mean,
you
also,
I mean,
like,
just I you, within yeah. you. I'm sorry. I mean, is there any kind of like feeling that comes up? Oh
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there's always, I think the blanket, right? I think for most people, there's the oh shit,
right,
especially
right.
when you know when you got caught.
Right. Yeah.
That's there. Like, yeah. It's like forgetting your homework when it's due, or the
right,
test.
Right, right, right.
Like, oh,
yeah.
So there's that general thing, but even I think. I mean, really, it's more like if I'm just driving and like I see this, you know, police cars patrolling around, they always patrol, you know, they're on the routes, and one happens to be behind you, and you're like, and I think we all have that apprehension about, like, you know, we're not doing anything wrong, but a cop car's behind you, you know, you're like, okay, I'm taking a left, are they taking a left with you?
Right,
and
then right.
They peel off at some point. But as a Black guy, like, my mind immediately goes there, right? And that's, I know that is not uncommon for Black Americans, because you just don't know, right? You don't know. I mean, mistaken identity. Like, I have low cut hair, right? Like 6 feet, which, you know, I pick a profile. I could literally fit a profile of a lot of people. And that's the thing too, in terms of situation, back to your other point, I've been at events, and I mean, again, it wasn't anything bad, but like, I just got confused. There'd be two Black guys there, and I got confused with someone else, right? Like, it's almost, Now, I would almost think like me confusing, like, you know, in a room full of like white people, me confusing two white people would be easier. It would make more sense.
Right.
But there's two black people there. And I've joked my friends about this. Like there's two of us. It can't be that hard. Right.
Right.
It can't
right.
be. Like, one time, one guy won an award. And then after the award, yeah, he was on the stage getting the award, getting a drink. And then after the deal, like, the slaves congratulating me on winning the award. And I'm like, Jesus Christ. I'm part like, but this, that's a good example, right? Like, yeah. Yeah, nothing bad. I mean, she didn't like call me anything, but it's just the thing of, yeah, they're literally, he was literally on stage and looks actually looked nothing like me, but he's black. And that was
right,
it.
Right.
Right. So it can be, you know, again, right, kind of, I definitely understand I have a lot of privilege in this world. And though that probably has mentions of our first world kind of problem, but the essence of it is this, that's a situation where it's mistaken identity and like a kind of a, you know, whimsical little fun party thing. It could easily be me just walking like to my, around my office downtown, you know, coming back from an event at midnight or 2 a.m.
and right.
like not so much a fun situation.
Right. Right. From what I've researched for the last month, I find that all of this kind of leads back to the first blockbuster movie, Birth of a Nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where everything that a white guy has heard his, you know, a crazy aunt say, oh, don't go into that side of town. There's a lot of black people. You know what I mean? Look out. You got to look out. And you realize that there's this sort of like ingrained irrational fear of other people that just the male black figure itself is threatening to some beyond belief because of this weird perpetuated image that was like passed down from generation to do you think it's that like sort of like almost like generational trauma?
Well, I mean, and so for those who are familiar with the movie, The Birth of a Nation, it was WB, no, it was
Big Griffin, yeah.
Yeah, but it was like, you know, silent film, black and white film, national blockbuster, Johnny said. And again, I'm not an academic on this. I remember seeing it in high school as a part of history class. The whole point of that movie was, it was like the Klan was prominently displayed as being heroes, saving the South from carpetbagging black businessmen and politicians who are coming there. This was post during Reconstruction, and you know, the gallantry of the Klan saving white women from these hyper-masculine, hypersexual, just black men. And I think so. I would agree. I don't think it's trauma so much as like it's just a perpetuation of the dominant group over a group that they wanted to subordinate. But black. Just from what I remember studying in college about this, just in a course, I mean, the idea, I think, really perpetuated from slavery, right? Like, it was twofold. One, right? Like, black men were these bucks, right? You're supposed to be,
right.
You know, a lot of times enslaved, and they bred people like this to farm fields, tobacco, all this stuff. And in the same vein, black women were promoted as being hypersexualized and everything else, too. And that carries over to this day. A lot of little girls... I mean, they said like they did a survey and like white people see overall like little black girls as being adults when they're 8, right? And so all that's being said, you see it like it's a fear. I think it was one, the glorification, like, you know, look how, you know, strong this black guy is, slave is, but also the fear, acknowledgement of like, this guy's bigger and stronger than me. And what happens if there's an uprising,
right?
Which that was the biggest fear, right? That's why you had the black codes, you had, you know, you couldn't travel only so far, you couldn't read, all these things. But a lot of it was based on the fear of what happens when this group, when and if this group rises up, right, in the South. And a lot of things were built around that fear because, you know, we're all, I mean, in the day, like they try to dehumanize us, but we're all human beings. And you know, when, you know, subjugated people at some point only, you know, we're only stay down for so long.
Right, right. Also, thanks for explaining the stuff that I'm just going over real fast to my audience.
No, it's like, yeah,
you're a great host.
Show. Yeah.
By the way,
the show notes.
I like your podcast a lot. People can find it's called the BG Podcast. It's conversations at the intersection of business, community, and public policy. You can find it wherever you find podcasts. What do you put out, like 2 shows a week?
Yeah, I started doing 2 shows last week or so for a while. Like we're in episode, we'll be on episode 90.
98 to next
day.
Week, yeah.
Yeah, but like basically I was trying to get to 100 faster. So I'm like, I started doing Wednesday and Friday. But every Wednesday I've been the format for a long time. Interviewed politicians, community leaders. I had Jackie Vinson on. We were recorded last week, and I'm posting that one later today.
Oh, okay,
this
good.
Friday, the 3rd. She had some kind of similar deal. She had, if you saw on the paper, she had some interesting things to say.
Yeah,
she's doing some events with Blues on the Screen on the 8th.
On the 8th, yeah, next Wednesday. I listened to your Juneteenth episode, and she was my Juneteenth episode.
Okay.
So
yeah. Yeah.
So as for people that don't know, Jackie Vinson is an artist here in town who was offered a gig playing a Blues on the Green show, and she stood up and said that she wanted to see an all-black bill. It had been years since there had been a black headliner, since I think 2015 or 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a couple of black people per year, and that's it. Just kind of like to check this box. And mm-hmm. she realized that for many years she had been playing the part of that and benefiting from it. And she decided to stand up and say no. She went back and forth with a guy in town, a well-known quote-unquote gatekeeper, Andy Langer. And mm-hmm. And then she was given the chance to put together her own bill and doing Blues on the Screen. And that's going to be it. And she, one thing I do want to point out as a fellow artist, I'm a musician as well. I found it huge that she didn't put herself on the bill. Mm-hmm. I thought it was huge that she curated a bill and put it together, because if you know Jackie and you talk to her, and people that listen to this show are familiar with her, she's been on 4 or 5 times. That is an ambitious woman. Like she creates and makes opportunities for herself, and to do it for just the community, I thought was a pretty huge thing. So you guys were talking about that, and in that episode, I believe it's episode 97 or something.
Let me check right now.
It's called Juneteenth. I'm sorry. Episode 95.
Yeah,
sorry.
June 19th. Yeah. you're asking about the episode number. That's right.
Right. Okay.
Wrapping all this, we're in COVID time, so like get mixed up.
Yeah.
It was episode 94.
Right. So in there, one of the things that I thought was interesting was the guy was saying, like, well, now Juneteenth, like, people will know what it is. They're talking about it. It's out there. Some people didn't know about it. We know about it in Texas, because this is where on June 19th in Galveston, a man gave the last, this was the last place, right?
Yeah, it's like a Brigadier General. I mean, yeah, it is the news, the official federal news, union news reached here.
Right. It was like 2 years, but wasn't it?
Yeah.
like two years.
I mean, I think people probably knew. They had wire service back then. It was just, you know, the actual military force reached here and said, hey, this isn't happening anymore. Legal,
right.
Anyway.
Well, I thought your response was very interesting. You
were
like, your response was like, yeah, well, we'll see how it goes. Like, if people will go on celebrating it. And I get that feeling. So do you feel like there could be, like, a false wave? Like, a wave that's going to peter out like they all have before?
Yeah, I think so. I would say this, just I would, for Black Americans saying this. I mean, our people, you know, our people, you know, last, say, 200 years, right? Say, post-Civil War. Starting with the Emancipation Proclamation, starting with the Constitution and ideas of equality, but the Emancipation Proclamation and what that was supposed to do, and what we saw happen after the Civil War, after Reconstruction ended and the Union Army pulled out of the South, we saw an immediate return to what it was before, sharecropping and everything else, that slavery, more outright slavery. We saw the Black Codes, and that all of this lasted through up until the 1960s, we had the Civil Rights Bill. It was brought in force by the federal government to do desegregation and to enforce, or to break down poll testing and everything else, right? And so through all that time, you know, our people in the whole heard a lot of promises from politicians and parties in particular, you know, where they switched, you know, Republicans, the Republicans are more liberal at one point, now it's Democrats, but it's just this and that, because we, as a people, will vote pretty loyal, as people will vote pragmatically, with whoever we get the best deal, even if they swallow it, it's not everything we're going to get, because we want survival more often than not. And so, you know, in this current era, you know, even though we are as a voting block, I think the strongest from Democrats, I don't think they've delivered. And this is something I think is common. You see this up and down the chain of Black America. We'll do it because the alternative is not tenable in the least.
Right.
Right. Right. I mean, I have Black Republican friends, but it's just not on the whole for our people. It's not a liberal. It's really just who's the better party for us. And, you know, and that's it. Cause it's for us, it's been about survival.
Yeah. Yeah. So you own a lobbying firm. Is that what?
That's correct. Yeah. The Bidding Group.
Okay. Yeah. You are the CEO. So you are a lobbyist. So to like the layman, not in politics at all, like to me, when I hear lobbyist, the first thing that comes to mind is Black Manafort and Stone. I assume that that's not what you don't represent.
No, Ukraine.
Yeah. Who was the guy named Black? He was the main guy. And he brought in Paul Manafort and Roger Stone and then Lee Atwater and shit.
Yes. Yeah. I forgot. I mean, I guess because the news, right, the cycle of things, that was only 2 years ago, but it's just, you know, there's been murder hornets and COVID and everything else. But yeah, that Jack Abramoff is back in the news actually recently.
Oh, really?
He got caught up with some other stuff last week. But for lobbyists, what we do, and your listeners and you aren't alone in that. Most people hear about lobbying is, you know, Jack Abramoff or
right,
those kind of thing.
Or the tobacco lobby, or politicians saying we got to stop these lobbyists.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people lobbying for good. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, while also taking our PAC money.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, people lobbying for good. And so, you know, what interested me about this profession, and I was a poli sci major, but I didn't know any lobbyists until my last year of law school. And you don't need to be a lawyer to go to law school, but that's what my path. And it was very interesting to me, just again, similar to my show, you realize, well, at least the contract lobbyists like myself, like I have like a hired gun, but what I really enjoy about this, my side of the, you're part of the sandbox, is you're at the intersection of all these different kinds of conversations. And yeah, I mean, there is money to be made if you're, you know, but it's definitely a hustle business where you have to go out there and find clients and win and be good, you know, be effective, have relationships. What I really fundamentally enjoy is just knowing what's going on, right? And it's a very social profession too, you know, by the nature of it. So you can't, you know, you have to make actual friends. Like, it's not just you, like Johnny, you might like, because a lot of times you may hate my client, who that client may be, but we have to, on some level, it's a very human business, right? It is, to me, I don't mean this thing, I almost thought about being a sports agent or talent agent after law school too. Because the same kind of thing, you need relationships, you need information. And that's fundamentally the business that I'm in, mm-hmm. is information.
Right.
I take the information and I help my clients' interests or further interests or campaigns and things like that too. And so it's not so insidious. Like in any industry, there are bad actors. I'm sure your listeners by and large have had bad talent. Or by bad, I mean like people who skimmed like off of their, you know, their bookings,
sure.
or those kind of things. Bad agents. Bad talent managers,
bad drummers.
Yeah, bad drummers. Yeah, yeah. You know, just people who are watching your books are supposed to watch your back and didn't, right? Yeah. And they're fiduciary to you. What we do, though, on the whole, there are a lot of great lobbyists. I have a lot of friends who are lobbyists for companies, who have their own firms as well, and also folks who lobby for nonprofits, American Heart Association, NAACP, any group or interest for your listeners' benefit, any group of interest out there. Has someone, whether they call them a lobbyist or not, it could be government affairs, it could be advocacy, but they are representing an entity's interests before a certain body of government. It could be the school district, it could be the county, city, state government, the feds, right?
Yeah.
They all have them. Any interest. The thing is, and it's in your First Amendment right, you know, free speech, there's a provision to petition the government. What it does, it doesn't, you know, gives everyone. Theoretically, everyone has the right to petition the government for grievances, right? And this came over from England, the right to petition the king, or the queen. Now, you have to talk sometimes that people want to say, well, you know, so-and-so's company has like AT&T is like 100 lobbyists, right, on retainer. But that's their right to do, right? No one, you know, the Constitution doesn't set a bar, it sets the floor, right?
Right, right.
Now, you know, obviously the courts and states can debate and what those limits are. But on the right, with free speech, it's a very dangerous ground to say, like, what person like as I as AJ Bingham go out there and hire 100 lobbyists if I wanted to, if I had the money, right? And I'm exercising my right to petition the government by hiring contractors to do it for me. And the minute we get in these conversations about how you limit that, and I get it, I can on the whole understand the optics of that, how saying, oh yeah, well, why should Halliburton or any kind of company have all these lobbyists and they have inordinate amount of power and so on. But on the flip side, the minute you start saying, well, so and such company can only have this many at this, who's to say, I mean, you get any arguments about free speech, right? And who can do what? With their money and like the law, whether it's you, it could be a music coalition, it could be anything. And that's not something, a game people want to play. I think what do we want to get into, because they might not like what the results are.
Yeah. So did just a quick change. Did you grow up here in Austin? You grew up here.
I did. Yeah. My dad was an Air Force officer. So we've been here since 91. Those who have been here for a while, the now airport or ABIA used to be an Air Force base. So we got stationed here in 91. And the same year, the base, they announced it was going to go through a phase closeout. And my parents decided to get the military at that point. So we landed in Austin.
Okay. And you, so you went to law school, you were in poli sci. What kind of, like, were you a very interested student? I mean, you seem like a very energetic,
yeah.
interested in learning person.
Yeah, I think so. I grew up in Austin. I went to, now it's called the Liberal Arts and Science Academy, but when I was in high school, it was LBJ Science Academy and some public magnet school. Really, really, really good school. You have to apply to get into. It has kids from across the district. So it was cool just for me to meet kids from across Austin before it was Facebook or internet, or not, yeah, good internet or anything else like that. I grew up in South Austin. And, I mean, I was poli-sci major. I mean, honestly, I should have did history. I'd like that more. But I honestly, it was a work in progress. Things didn't really click to my mind until I met these lobbyists and focused on, like, oh, I'm going to Austin. I just turned 25 and that I want to do this, right? I didn't really have an idea, honestly, about where I want to, even when I went to law school. I didn't know. I wouldn't advise that for anyone, but it's just how it worked for me. I just didn't know, right? It was like, it was almost the dots got connected in reverse to a degree, right? And thankfully it clicked. And, you know, I still treat like a working thesis. Like, I think I could be good at lobbying. I think, you know, give me, you know, that was the thing. When I met these folks, and they were established then, it was like, okay, if I'm 25 now, where could I be by the time I'm 45? Because at 45, even in the lobby, I'm still young, relatively speaking. So at 45, give me 20 years. Where will I be in 20 years? Could I legitimately see myself being like so-and-so, who's a top dog now? I'm like, yeah. I mean, whether we'll see what happens, but I felt, you know, give me 20 years of hustle and getting after it, and I could be that person. And then I'd never felt that before in the area of the law where I saw some partner. I'm like, you know, can I see myself in their seat?
Right.
And that was the thing. I was like, I want to go after this. And, you know, I advise anyone, I don't know how the age range of listeners, but if someone's not yet in their career, especially if you feel that thing and you know, right, whether it's for musicianship or wherever it is, listen to that voice. I mean, you know, take the qualified exception around it. Like if it's something where you need more money, you know, figure out how to get there, right? But listen to that voice, because like it's that, from that one thing has flowed everything else I've done, to starting my own firm 3 years ago, to the podcast, to, you know, just everything, you know, meeting you, right? That all flowed from me wanting to be a lobbyist and having that, not just being a lobbyist, but wanting to be the best and the drive to that.
Yeah. Do you have political aspirations at all?
I do not at this time.
Okay.
That's because
it's a very diplomatic answer. Yeah.
Yes. Nothing goes ever off the table. But again, I feel, having been around a lot of great politicians in my career now, over 10 years, I've been in the lobby, hit 10 years June 1st. What I'll say is, I want to feel the same passion and kind of drive I felt when I was talking about what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
I need to feel that same way. I would need to feel that call. Like, not like the, you hear people say, oh, I felt, you know, I prayed about it, I felt called to do it.
Right.
Sure. I know for myself, though, there's that voice in my head. It's like, you have a, I could truly believe, one, that I can win, and also that I'd be better than everyone else.
Right.
Because I've seen campaigning campaigning and legislating, right? And again, not having been an official, but being close to all these folks.
Sure.
Campaigning can be a brutal process, right? It can be, you know, constant. I mean, you have to, it's a hard marathon. It's not just you shaking hands and anything else. All these meetings, all these phone calls, campaign phone calls, asking for money. And then once you're, then, you know, you win and you're on the dais. And now you may have, you know, the council, you might have 10 other colleagues, and you may get along with some of them, you may not go along with others. And not only that, you have issues that you campaign on that you want to do, but you still have to now politic and make it and navigate these 9 other 10 other members, right? And if you don't have the inner drive, that fire to go through all that,
yeah.
And you know, I can't be in anyone's head, but like, if you need that, I feel like just to be the best kind of politician, you need that thing, or you truly believe it, because 9 times out of 10, you're doing things that you're voting on things in the dais that have nothing to do with anything you care about, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you care about it in the sense that you're there for official business, but you have your priorities, but now you're part of something that represents in the council's case, the whole city.
Right.
But it could be the Congress too, or anything else. You gotta want it, and then hopefully have an idea, really have a clear understanding of what you're gonna be doing, right?
Yeah.
But it's not a, and I feel when I feel that, and I know for me too, when I feel that thing, that's the only way I'll be most effective campaigner, dollar raiser, and official, is when I truly feel that thing where I feel calling. For my lobby firm now. The calling.
Yeah.
Because when I have that, I mean, I can't guarantee I'll win, but like, I mean, when those times of my life where I'm fully aligned, where everything is running to full strength, like, right. I'm pretty dangerous with that stuff.
Right.
Whether it's rhetoric or anything else, like I'm fully convinced. I'm pretty good at convincing other people too.
Yeah.
When I'm fully bought in.
Yeah. It's, can I ask you, you're in the system. You work with the system.
Yes. That's the nature of the job. Yeah.
Yes. And so from your point of view, how difficult and how, and can we change the system, like this, like the way that it needs to be changed to end systemic racism?
I think it's acknowledging that it has to be a generational effort, right? It's like on a base analogy. It's like if you're overweight, right? You don't lose what, I mean, it took you years to gain a lot of weight, right? And the same way, you're not going to lose it like that. Right. It's going to take time. It'll take as much, probably more time to undo it, right? It as will with anything.
Right.
And the same way with institutional racism, I mean, it's been in our country for 400 years.
Yeah.
It is not going to go away from Facebook posts, hashtags, or even marches, right? It takes the will of the full people, because it's not just a black problem, it's an American problem, right? It takes the full will of the people and the government, federal government and state governments, local governments, to want to do it. And then commit to instituting the tools that get us there. You're not going to, I think you're not going to change. You can't enforce someone's mind and how they think, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, people are going to think they were going to think. And yeah. what we see now is most people, 9 times out of 10, aren't going to call me the N-word. They may be thinking it all day, but they know better than to say it out loud because it's not acceptable, right?
Right.
Or sexism or homophobia or transphobia, right? All of these things, people know better than just say it out loud, even though they may believe it. And we'll never know. They'll be filling your face, but you'll never know, right? With this, though, looking at what are all the things, the barriers that we can do, you know, again, institutionally, right? So if it's home loans, is it the policing side of things?
Right, right.
Working on those, we're also knowing that this isn't going to be an easy fix, right? This is not going to be, it will truly be a multi-generational effort. Like, it's something, so say we started in 2020. I mean, honestly, you imagine that, you know, there's a commitment to the country to do it, which I don't think there would be. Yeah, I would say, like, this is at least a 100-year plan, like, to, you know, to 2021, 2022 to do, because it's just, I think it's something you have to look at on a grand scale to do, because otherwise what will probably happen now is you try to do all these things and there's going to be all these little fixes that do nothing, right? They get forgotten in like a year or two. And I'm hopeful and I'm an optimist, right? But I'm also, I mean, I know the history of this country, of Black America, right? And I'm not that optimistic about it. I mean, it's just, I believe when I see it. And I think that it holds true. Like my household, my parents are both 65. I'm 37. My brother's 28. You know, when we cover, you know, a good range of generations there. And no, I don't think, I mean, we just won't believe when I see it. We're trying to live our lives and best we can, but it's just a lot that, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be easily undone. I think the work to do it is not what, I don't think a lot of people are overly optimistic in how fast it can be done.
Right.
Now, if I'm proven wrong, obviously, if I'm wrong about that, I mean, I will be proven wrong. But I feel the commitment to it, I mean, it's like the same thing when people join gyms at the beginning of the year, right? Like that kind of thing. On a very, I think, probably solid analogy, yeah. It's all great. Oh, new year, new me, da-da-da, first month in. Like, let's see who you are by the next January. Most people, this is proven, quit because it gets too hard. And it will be hard to do. It'll be immensely hard when you do this, primarily because then to undo institutional racism means that a large part of this country, a lot of white people, are going to lose things, honestly, they never had to really think about, right? But all of a sudden, I mean, that's the insidiousness of institutional racism is, like, Johnny, it's require you to do anything. You just be white and live your life.
Yeah.
And you're benefiting from it, right?
Yeah.
So to consciously say, I'm willing to give it up. And that's a human thing. Why would you, right? You can say it all day on Facebook. When it comes down to it, why would you give up the chance, like, of, you know, your son or daughter not having a chance to go to a good school over someone else, right? And that's how it'll be framed. And am I optimistic? Yeah, but it's human nature as well. And again, it's one thing to say things out on Facebook or everything else. It's another thing to be in a voting booth when no one's around you and doing something.
Yeah,
it's true, right? Yeah. Like, so we will know, you know, I think the biggest barometer to me of all this, all these talks, something else now, is what happens in November in the elections. And that, you know, everything else to me, we'll see what happens. Everything else right now, I think the most immediate thing is everything else flows from that, what happens in November, because that the presidential election has everything to do with who gets in the Supreme Court. Probably several picks we made there, at least two in that first term. If not, if it goes to a two-term presidency for a Democrat, at least two, right? Maybe three or four. And then also what goes on in the House and Senate at the federal level, right? We saw a few weeks ago, House leadership, Nancy Pelosi, and several members of Congress, you know, they're in kente cloths and like kneeling at, I don't know, there's some exhibit in D.C. And it means nothing to me, right? It means nothing, I think, to most Black Americans. It's pageantry. Just get the bills passed and push through and fight and get it done.
Right.
Right. That's what we want.
Yeah.
I want to set the law and enforcement of the law.
Yeah. It's weird. I was thinking about something you said in your podcast that you were talking about, and I'm trying to get it right in my mind because I listened to it, but I did not write down what you said. But it was, you were talking about banks, and there was a bank that was showing, like doing something, like saying, hey, we stand with Black people or something. But then you were like, I wonder if they would open their books and let you see how they loan money and who they, you know what I mean? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know that was me or my guest, but the point that's been known. I mean, like loan preferences, right?
Right.
Who got loans, who didn't get loans. I mean, and that's been going on for decades. You know what blue lining was?
Yeah. Right? I didn't know until the last month. I've learned a lot of stuff.
Yeah. This relates to it, right? But for those who don't know on the show, I mean, blue lining was city policies that basically, I mean, they had a map of the city, had a blue, like architecture, was it a blueprint pen, right?
Yep.
Blue pencil. And they lined out like this area here it was state city sanctioned segregation. And in Austin that happened, they had the 1928 master plan, which for those who don't know what that was basically what is now I-35, the city father or city leadership at the time made everything east of what is now I-35, the Black and Mexican part of town.
Uh-huh.
And then everything west of that was the white part of town. And for example, Clarksville was a freed slave community up until then. And then basically after that line got drawn, if you were Black and lived west of 35, you weren't getting power to your house or sewage or anything else. And you weren't get your kids certainly were going to school over there. Right.
Jesus.
And those things. So you factor that into then loan preferences. Like I want to build an addition to my house. I want to get a loan for my business.
Right.
Right. Those are institutional things. And I don't think I said that, but I'd love to see that because again, talk is the talk, right? I think what I said actually was, I remember now, it was more not about the banks, it's about companies though that have all these posts about Black Lives Matter inclusion. Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, you know, and you know, I'm like, the mission was job, but I don't want to see your VP diversity who's Black. I want to see your CFO. I want to see your VP track, your leadership development team of folks who are on the track.
Exactly.
Be future leaders. And future leaders in terms of the hard C's, I mean, like CFO, CEO, COO, that stuff, the real inner circle, the executive board. Because if I don't see that, I'm like, and it's not something you can do right away. And it shouldn't be done like that, right? Though people are out there to do. It should be done in a thoughtful way. But if I don't see it, and I do feel, I speak for a lot of Black America in saying this, we look, I can go on your site and see it, right? So I look down your site, oh, I see your org chart. You're, you know, I see, okay, manager, one Black manager, VP track, everyone's white, or not Black. I'm like, and it doesn't mean anything to me.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, it means as much of, I see what you're saying, but I look at this and don't see anything about it. So, and I'm not an idiot. So I'm like, yeah, I think basically you're getting all the time because, you know, you had to say something, but I haven't really seen anything of it, you know? And I'm not talking about a VP of diversity. You right. see a lot of that. Those are important roles, but the thing is, those roles don't only matter as much as they have the power to do their job, to do what they need to do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you see that play out a lot. All these companies will announce VPs of diversity, but if your whole C-suite's white, it doesn't do anything, right? Yeah. I look at that and like, sure, I wish that person well, you know, a VP job, hope they can do well in it, but they can't succeed unless they have the same thing with the government, the weight of the executive leadership behind them to do what they need to do.
Right.
Because even it's not easily undone. It is not.
No. No, there's a lot of work to do, man. But I feel like I'm hopeful.
I mean, we all have hope. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I think there's the hope of America.
Yeah.
There's the, what America could be.
Yeah.
Which is what we all strive for. And it's imperfect, right? There are people who will talk about American exceptionalism, like this country hasn't, you know, to be where you are as a country in this world doesn't come from just being nice, right?
Right.
We know that. I mean, you can read any kind of history book and know the things we've done in other countries, something else. And fair enough, that's geopolitics. But there's a hope of what America could be. And I think on some level, we all strive for that to be. But, you know, it's like there's the ideal gets tempered with the realities of us as people, right? And in our own imperfections. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, hopefully we can reconcile that in generations to come. I mean, you know, even, you know, look, from the 60s to now, things have changed, right? There is change and there will always be change.
Yeah.
And I think it won't be immediate for want, but there is change. I mean, pretty much everything I do in my life now, I could not have done in 1950, 1940, not readily, not
right.
with the free.
Exactly.
Not, to be able just to do everything I do, actually, not a chance, not even close. My social, the things, everything I do, right, would not have been impossible. Oh, this level of openness, you know, 50 years ago, probably.
Yep.
So I acknowledge that too. There's, you know, a lot of things, and that's what drives me a lot too, Johnny, is the fact that recognizing I happen, you know, by virtue of just whatever, I was born at this time in this country, which is still, I think, one of the greatest countries in the world. In terms of opportunity, one of the greatest countries in the world for opportunity for, you know, Black, whatever else, to be able to, as a Black person especially, to be able to come to be in this country in this time. And be able to, you know, have the parents I did and the faculties I did and the luck for sure to blessings and our luck to pursue my American dream, right? To build a business, to have, you know, a diverse team, insurance, or, I mean, to really go for it and have the desire and the full view that, you look, I can be, you know, I'm in a very, very, very white field and I want to be the best. And there's one or two people I can look to in my profession who are Black, who are that, are where I want to be. Not a lot, nationally. And I feel not like in a hope one day kind of thing, like I can legitimately do it and have a shot at that, and I feel that in my soul. And that's something I couldn't have probably had 60 years ago.
No.
So things go, and things will move, right? And it's just the hope of maybe every generation, we just move it a little further. And that's the best we can do, but that's more than nothing, right?
Yeah, yeah. James Robinson and I have a friend named Bevis. Do you know Bevis Griffin?
Yeah, we James connected us this last week, and yeah, we've been corresponding some.
That's good. Yeah, Bevis says the change is glacial.
It is. Yeah. It's glacial, but it moves. And, you know, you might not see it in your lifetime. I think, you might see it in your lifetime, but the hope is like, what did I do just to move it just a bit, bit. I think if we all focus on that, even that can shift things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully, I mean, I feel like at least for myself, and I think a lot of people that I do know, this time for the last month since the murder of George Floyd, has been an awakening to like, oh yeah, I can't just kind of sit around and be like, well, I'm not racist, so, and then go do your life again. You know what I mean? Like, you got to kind of like actively step up and move for the change, you know, which is uncomfortable to do. And a lot of people, I think, in my position didn't know how to do it as a white person. Like, I don't want to go pretend I'm, you know what I mean? To be disingenuous and be like the white black guy, like, you know?
Yeah. And I think this too, right? Like, it's just our country. When I say I'm hopeful, but you know, we'll see what happens, because our country, I believe, can only handle one big national conversation at a time.
Yeah.
And I mean, cause look, we went from like COVID to this, like a reprieve, you know, it is what it is. Like, it was a reprieve from COVID for some people. And now we're back to COVID. The tail of the tape to me is going to come down to what are people saying about all of this stuff with George Floyd and Black Lives Matter. And not people, because black people are always going to say it, right? Again, it doesn't matter what happens with the general, you know, the main population. Black Lives Matter and these issues are always issues for the black community, will always be. Wherever people want to have, you know, do the blackout posts, those kind of things, it doesn't matter. Until, you know, it'll always be there for us. But as a national conversation, and that's what takes away change things, we'll see. I mean, it's borne out the last several, for decades. Like, we can't handle two things at once. Right? They can't do it. And again, this is the first time everything, we'll see. But if the big tale of tape to me in all of this is what happens. And I mean, I think what happens in November, honestly, I'll leave it at that. What happens in November really determines to me where our country stands on race.
Yeah.
It's a lot that starts at the top.
Yeah. Speaking of the top, there's also like down ballot voting that I think a lot of people don't educate themselves very well on, because it's not as prevalent in the news as the president's. But these are really important things. Can you, as a person that has some inside knowledge, can you give me and my audience some advice on educating ourselves on those people running for judges? And like, is there a place where you can go and really read what these people stand for?
Yeah, a few sources, right? So, you know, this is again for people based in Austin, Texas. I mean, you have the Austin American Statesman, the main paper here, will profile the candidates, and they'll do give you their picks. The Austin Chronicle, more left leaning, right, but they always do, I think, a very robust job of laying out the candidates and who they pick. And then ultimately, right, like all these candidates have websites, so I think you can go to I can send you a link for this, right? But you go to Travis County. Travis County has an election site, because they administer elections, and they'll lay out the ballot. So you can see, like, the ballot you'll see in your booth is a ballot. They have a copy of the PDF online. And the best way to really know the candidates is to look them up, right? Like, I mean, look up their website, look at their campaign site, and see what they're about, and then, you know, make an informed decision. Right. If you read the Chronicle or you read the Statesman, you'll get information from the candidates, but you're also going to get just the pick that the Statesman had or the Chronicle had. And those are based on what those interviewers that interviewed the candidates felt, which may or may not be aligned with your value. It may be aligned with your values. It's fine. But I think the purest way to do it is just to look the candidates up on your own and read about them. And, you know, and then if there's time, attend a candidate rally. And that's the thing, right? Engaging in the political process. I teach a class on this on government relations at Rice MBA online.
Yeah, by the way, that's super cool. Like,
Just multifaceted, right? It's fun.
Yeah.
But one of the early topics is about the cost of political participation, right? The same reason, I mean, it's a time thing. It's just for the average, like for someone like me, like I'm paid to help to augment someone's engagement in the community, or engagement in politics, right?
Right, right.
Like Johnny, you're running a studio, in a band, or anything else. the best use of your time isn't to be at City Hall or the Capitol, but you hire me, and this right. is kind of, you hire me to be your eyes and ears. I know your priorities. I know the things you care about, and to target or to track those things around the Capitol, wherever it may be, and to let you know and to distill and say, Johnny, look, here's what happened today. I think we need to go to a meeting at the Capitol. You and me need to go. So I'm going to get these meetings set up. And then we're going to talk about these things, but they need to hear it from you because you're a real person who is affecting.
Right.
But to make sure I'm the bridge for you to the Capitol or else. So when we go there, you're set up to success. You can talk what you talk about, and everything else is handled for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I get, but most people obviously don't have that. And so I would say, honestly, right now more so because we're all should be at home, just look them up.
Okay.
Get the ballot, look them up. And I mean,
and even if you don't live in Austin, you can look in your paper, you can go to your county's correct. Website.
Yeah. But also, you can also just follow them on Facebook. Most of these candidates now, given especially everything with COVID, they've switched all their events to virtual anyway. So the barrier to entry is a lot lower. You can go, attend a Zoom rally for someone and listen to them speak with their issues on Zoom. You can, interact with them on Facebook. I think the barriers, and there's any positives from COVID is on the political side is the fact that it's made at least the local government, more accessible, I think, to the public. Because in the past, like every council meeting right now is they're all streamed, right? So you could, as before, you had to be, council streamed too, to participate, you had to be in person at a meeting right. to testify.
Right.
Now you can call in. I mean, there's a dial-in number and everything else, and you're queued. But you can call in and you can be at your home, you can be at your office and break out to testify. As before, if you're going to speak at council, you might have to be there all day.
Yeah.
And again, you're not being paid while you're there.
Right.
Ideally,
right.
most likely.
Right. I guess I wonder if there's a way to sort of, I would hope that with the current regime that we're under and all of the other sort of like political facets going on, maybe people will take the time to investigate these candidates and stuff for themselves. That's the tough part is like trying to make people eat vegetables. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think it's, what I'll say is this, right? Local government, you brought this up earlier. People don't understand how critical that is. I think the feds, obviously the national elections get the presidency and such get a lot of view, right? Cause it's the crown jewel, I guess you will. Right. But these local elections, they're deciding zoning cases. They're deciding permits. If you want a new bar, if you want to build a sound studio in your house, these things matter a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't get it. They don't really realize it until it happens. Downtown parking, when they started making metered parking.
Yeah.
Always people were bellyaching about it. Right. And it'd been on the agenda for 2 weeks at council. No one testified on it. No one really brought it up. It got passed. And then all of a sudden it was an issue.
Yeah.
So yeah.
We just need to be more involved. We have this beautiful democracy that is supposed to be for the people, by the people. But sometimes we find ourselves either too busy or too busy pacifying ourselves in ways that don't get us actually involved.
Yeah, and I think, they got some ideas flowing for me. Like after we hit episode 100, I was looking for new kind of topics. But I may run a series about just engaging with city government for Austin.
Yeah, well, people can find that podcast. It's great, man, and I look forward to listening to more. You're a great host, and you really are. You're just chock full of information, AJ.
I try. Go ahead.
People can find the BG podcast wherever you find podcasts. They can find you at binghamgp.com. Mm-hmm. I know there's probably a million other things we could talk about. I'd love to have you on again at some point and just kind of like touch base and maybe closer to the election is something if you have time.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
It'd be great. I think, your show, Johnny, thanks for having me on. I think I'm not your usual guest.
No.
Time. I think, I love having the little crossover. So,
I think it's important at this time for like, it's a lot more important for you and I to have a conversation about this today than somebody releasing a new single next week. Not that that's not important, but right now we do need to sort of like realize that we're in a sensitive time, a time of movement to like really put our noses to the grindstone and help that movement,
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was a weird manifesto. dude, I hope you have a wonderful 4th of July. And I've really enjoyed talking to you. I want to thank James for introducing us. But yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Johnny. It's fun to be on the show. Happy to be on again.
Yeah,
take care. Do what you wanna do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. It's your thing.